You're a SaaS founder. You've built something solid, but growth still feels harder than it should. Most SaaS companies don't fail because of bad tech. They fail because they've never become a must-have to the right customer. This podcast is here to change that. I'm Ton Dobbe, and this is the Remarkable SaaS Podcast. Every week, I talk to founders in the trenches, facing friction, making bold moves, and building companies that last. We dig into real choices around focus, positioning, customer pool, team alignment, the things that separate forgettable software from the ones that people can't live without. No hype, no hacks, just honest conversations to help you build something that people would miss if it was gone. If your SaaS should be indispensable but isn't yet, this is your podcast. Let's get into it. The guest on my podcast this week is Sami Dindan, CEO of Hypefury.
Whatever time you spend on something, you don't spend on something else. So whatever time you're going to try to build something crazy for our platform, it's the time you're not spending improving. So it's opportunity cost, really.
This is Sami. We dig into how he achieves complete business freedom by serving only Twitter power users so well that they happily pay premium prices while he ignores everyone else. You'll hear how a three-day prototype turned into sustainable freedom and why his best features come from Telegram chats, not product meetings. It's a raw conversation about choosing constraints over growth and what happens when you let users become your product owners. Well, hi, Sami. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Yeah, I mean, the name Hypefury rang a couple of bells when I heard about it when we connected. And I was like, yeah, this is going to be a fun one to talk about, particularly also what's happening in the space and social, Twitter in its own right, and building companies around it. Before we start, a little bit about you. What drives you? What gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
Freedom, you know, doing what I like, serving my customers, time flexibility, you know, the lifestyle advantages it brings you.
Yeah. You're one of the first that I've actually said freedom. That is, and I like that. And I have seen that you started a company with a bootstrap mindset. And I also always applaud for that. Building a company that's what I call creates funding freedom. So that you might need it in the future, but then it's a choice. And you're in the negotiation position and not the other ones.
Well, that's the benefit of doing something online is that you don't need that much money to start. You know, you need time, energy. There are some businesses where obviously you need money, funding, ads, a lot of ads. Yeah. But in the terms of SaaS, you can do a lot of things the organic way.
Mm, yeah, completely agree with that. Yeah. It always depends, of course, and there's never a black and white in terms of it's what is good or what is bad. And if you're in deep tech, you're in deep tech. You have to invest a lot.
That's true.
Yeah. So, yeah, I agree. So, yeah, tell me a little bit about, making the bridge then to Hypefury. You started that in 2019, is what I saw.
Yes.
And it started as something that was a pain point that you covered yourself or experienced yourself. Yeah. What was that pain point that you had that was screaming for a solution and it wasn't there?
So it was Fred scheduling. So there used to be, and there still are a lot of scheduling tools in the market, but none did Twitter thread. So it's basically those tweets that reply to each other and then you have like a story. So there was no tweet to do that. So I decided as a fun project to learn new tech, to build one and try it. And I had a prototype working. Back in the day, I used to be in what they call the Twitter money space. So all these people trying to, you know, do side hustles, find new businesses, sell something. So I was in that space. I was also in a Telegram group with other people doing the same thing. So when I built the app I remember it was 3 days, I had a pretty ugly prototype working. It was ugly, it was working. I shared it with them and then they were like, yeah, that's cool. Can you add a button to do this? Can you add this feature? Can you give us the option to do this or that? And then I started implementing these features, and then I had a bunch of people using the app on a daily basis, and it was just a prototype. There was no billing, I wasn't charging or anything. It was just the bare app as I made it, being used by people on a daily basis. I'd say around five people, you know, maybe between 5 and 10 maybe. And yeah, and that's how it started.
That's it's the best way to start, because it is something that you see, or you get an advantage with it. And I completely agree. If you've always been posting things on Twitter, the ones that are most valuable at the end are the ones where the threads are, and you can actually tell a story, like you say.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of work to do that manually. And
yeah, especially on Twitter, because Twitter needs you to be posting 5-10 times a day. So it's a lot of work to be doing that manually. And then you want to do it with a scheduler, and then there was no scheduler to do that. So it was a very niche idea, niche problem, and a niche solution.
One of the things that always gets me then is, how do you build defensible differentiation? What have you done from the beginning, possibly differently, or have you maybe done quickly after that, so that you avoid others to come in your space as well? Or is this so niche that others just ignore it?
Yeah, it's true. It's pretty small. But later down the line, we had other products doing the same thing. We had a competitor copying everything we did, basically, like the UI, the features, the name of the features, the copy in the website. So there's nothing you can do about it besides creating a community around the product, being, let's say, genuine and organic in your communication. Like I had my Twitter account where I used to post like the new features, hype users and other people around the new features, the upcoming features. I also had a private beta, so I created like, again, a hype effect. So I used to give demos. So I did a lot of do the things that don't scale. Basically, in the beginning, I used to speak to people to give them a demo, to show them product, to give them free access. Well, back then I didn't have billing. Like I had billing maybe 5 or 6 months after creating the first version. And after every call, after every demo, I asked them for one person that could benefit from the product. So they introduced me to another person, and then I get another demo. So that's how I build the product in the beginning. You asked something about how to differentiate. Well, the way the product was different is just building what people needed, you know? Somebody needed one specific feature and we built it, and that feature didn't exist in the other product. Because in our case, the idea was everything that Twitter users did manually, and it was taking time, we automated it, you know?
Yeah.
Just a basic thing, for example, somebody posts a tweet and after 4 or 6 hours, they retweet it. So it pops back in their timeline. Well, we automated that, you know?
Yeah.
Or if their tweet gets popular, they plug their product, their book, their course, whatever. So we automated that too. So the way we, Hype3 was different, was it had all these Twitter niche specific features that our tools didn't have and didn't care to build, because their audience didn't really care that much about these specific features.
Yeah. You touched upon a very important topic here, talking about the niche, and that, technically, of course, everybody that's using Twitter can use your product. But you're making the distinction here that some don't bother about the features that you have, and others, I mean, it's day and night difference. It's their lifeline. So what have you done? How have you uncovered sort of your sweet spot where this product makes so much sense?
It's whether you're a power user or not. That's really different. So you have two people, one posts on every platform and to whom Twitter is just like an additional platform they need to be present in. And there are other people whose main platform is Twitter. They post on Twitter, they interact. It's basically their main marketing platform. So exactly, those people were our target. So it was mostly creators. It was really that, creators, people who sell digital products, solopreneurs.
Exactly. Well, that makes a lot of sense because I mean, in my book, I'm talking about valuable and desirable. And yeah, that's a combination that requires a specific context or a specific dynamic that needs to be in place with the buyer that is actually, that you have in front of you. So if it's their lifeline, if that's the way they do business, then that is, for them, the best product to have. And I like also what you're saying about doing what not scales. Because people can copy features, but they don't know the full story around it. Then, they're going to implement something that is just a feature, but doesn't do the job. How do you approach that, by the way, so that you build features that at the end are going to be those features where if you take them away, people start screaming, of that level of quality?
I don't have a magic formula. It just needs to get done. When somebody requests a feature, you decide, is it going to be used by one person or is it going to be benefit? Is it going to benefit almost all the other users?
Yeah.
And you decide if it's worth implementing or not.
Exactly. That is true. And of course, after a while, it becomes a dilemma because you get so many users and
Exactly, and so many features, but in the beginning you can afford to have too many features.
True.
There's only after a few months or a few years then you realize we're doing too much. We don't even have the space in the UI to put all these features, so maybe we need to start cutting some stuff. You start looking at how many people use that specific feature, can we afford to remove it?
Is that something you do, by the way? Because I mean, you're 6 years in the journey right now, so the product is mature.
Yeah, we've done it. We've done it multiple times. We cut some features. At some point they become, even technically, they become a big challenge to maintain, to test. So yeah, at some point we're like, hey, this feature, I don't think a lot of people use it, but I'm going to check. And then we see the usage and then realize there's like 10 people using it in a week. And then you're like, yeah, maybe it's not worth maintaining anymore. We're going to remove it and put something else instead of it. And there's another thing that other people do. I've never done it. They just remove the feature and see what's going to happen. If people are going to go to support and complain. If enough people go to support and complain, they keep it. They put it back. Yeah, exactly.
You're right. It's adding features is always the simplest way. And it's easy to put something on a roadmap. But I mean, I remember the tough conversations I had with the head of R&D at Unit 4, where I was planning new things and they say, well, do you really, really think you need it or believe you need it? Or have you proof for that? Because once it's in there, it's a liability for life. And this particular module, for example, is going to take at least half an FTE per year to maintain it. So yeah, you lose people on the way. But okay, it's all a business choice. What I like about your approach is that you, like you say, you do the hard things, you do demos, you do the long demos, you're constantly in contact with your users to understand from the outside in what is required rather than thinking about it yourself. And of course, initially you were a user yourself. That's how it started. It reminds me of a couple of chapters in my book. The one that comes to mind is chapter number 6, Remarkable SaaS Companies Create Fans, not just customers. And I mean, with a name called Hype Fury, I mean, there needs to be something that it's about people talking about things. And of course, you got the platform that people talk about things, which is Twitter. Mm-hmm. But have you also achieved that effect with Hype Fury itself, that people start become your best advocates?
Correct. It's people like it when you build something for them, and they like that proximity, especially in the beginning. Of course, you can't do that for like the whole life of the app. You can't please everyone, but especially in the beginning when you have 10, 50, 100 users, they love that they speak to the owner and he listens to them, and many times he implements whatever feature they want. And once you do that, you don't even need to convince them or ask them to speak about you. They're just going to do it by themselves. They're just going to post on Twitter, hey, I spoke to Sammy 2 days ago about this feature and it's live in the app. And I had that happen multiple times.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Have you experienced that it's harder now that you are 6 years in business, that the user group is larger, to keep that momentum about that people talk about Hype Fury? Or is it actually easier?
I'm not sure, but it's harder to create that like whoa feature, you know? There's a threshold where you start creating a bunch of cool features and then it gets harder and harder to create newer, cooler features.
Yeah. Are you optimizing for that? I mean, are you challenging your people in the company? Like, you know, the things that we have on the roadmap, of course, there are things that need to be done. There's things that need to be done from a security perspective, maybe. No one is going to talk about that or wow about it, but every release needs to have something like a moment. I mean, the reason why I'm bringing it up, it's one of the things that I've always been obsessed with as well. I mean, we were in the accounting space. I mean, how cool is that? You know, doing your finance. But even in that area, there are these moments where I call it peak moments, whereby you're solving something that people don't expect to be solved like that. You're there in the moments where it really needs to happen, and then it happens. And that's what people remember. You know, last week I was having this the podcast with the founder of Fathom, Richard White, similar type of things. Every release, there is something that they are specifically focusing on to create the peak moment. A lot of companies are actually filling the gaps or filling the cracks, whereby a lot of times users don't even bother too much about that, but they remember the moments where you shine to them.
Mm-hmm.
So well, I believe everybody can do it, but it's just a matter of willingness to look into it.
It's important. Sometimes you release something just for the marketing effect it's going to have. Mm. Definitely, you know?
Yeah. Oh,
true.
Yeah, exactly. Talking about your drive for bootstraps, freedom. How do you ensure that you're doing the things that make your business more sustainable over time? I mean, in my book, I'm talking about focusing on the essence, but it's a wide thing. It's focusing on the essence is about the product itself. It's about where you focus, where you're not focused in the market. Have you got certain philosophies or what is it, principles that you follow to keep the sustainability of the company growing?
Figure out what people want and build it for them.
It's a good theme. It's repeating as
it's a feedback loop that you need to listen to.
Yeah.
And really it's about that, you know, people are going to give you money if you solve their problems. The good news is that you're already solving a bunch of problems if you have users and you have money and you have a company. So as long as you keep doing that, it's good. But then you need to listen to what's the new thing in the market, you know? For example, AI. Everyone's talking about AI, so maybe you want to add an AI feature to your app, you know?
How do you go about that? Because, I mean, yes, the AI hype is there. I see a lot of companies adding AI just to tick the box. I've also seen a couple of companies that deliberately chose not to add AI. And I know a couple that were one of the biggest exits, for example, here in the southern region in 2024. I actually met the founder of the company on stage in Madrid recently. He deliberately decided there's no AI in this product or in this particular area because it just doesn't make sense. And so we're not following the hype and customers love it.
we implemented AI when I think ChatGPT-3 was released. It was like 3 years ago. But personally, I always found it gimmicky, and many of our users found it gimmicky because many of our users, I said, they're power users. They can write, you know, they have their own ideas. They can type them out in their own voice. So they don't need like some algorithm creating like bland tweets for them. But we still had it there, you know, just for the principle, you know, it's there if you want it. Maybe you just want to post something quickly, you don't have the time. So we're going to generate a bunch of tweets for you using your own voice. We're going to feed your own tweets to ChatGPT. It's going to give you like another 5 tweets. But I know that for our power users, it doesn't really matter. And well, in our business, I think the users who need AI to create tweets for them, they don't last long, you know, because in the end, as a solopreneur, as a creator, you're selling your voice. So if you don't even have a voice, if you can't even put your ideas into words in your own voice, how can you last? So for us personally, I think in our business, it's more than a gimmick or than anything, or something that you would use very rarely.
Yeah. Well, see how it is already is like how you're talking about it. It's a gimmick. Like we tick the box. Yes, we have it. No one is using it, which at the end is also a shame.
It's a shame. Why?
Well, yeah. We have, there's development power going in there.
Yeah, but at the same time, we had to experiment with it, you know? We couldn't just say no. When that's, for example, when I saw ChatGPT 5 for the first time, I was like amazed. I was really amazed. Like, this is, you know, it's magic. Yeah, so we had to experiment with it, and we had to offer it to our users, and then they decide. So we offered it to our users. We've seen that the response was mild, and then we left it there. It was working. But again, it's not something that power users would use a lot.
It's part of this whole journey, ticking the box of my book, chapter number 4, Mastering the Art of Curiosity. And that's about experimentation as well. It's about asking those questions, not waiting until the perfect moment, doing a number of things, and just get it out there for feedback. And if it doesn't resonate, just don't release it or keep it on the back burner.
Part of the game.
It's part of the game, exactly. And it's always part of the game. Now, talking about like the changing trends, this social is so, it's become so big over the last years. You started on Twitter. You dedicated your business around Twitter. Certain things happened with Twitter. Kind of going back to your customers again, what do they expect from you? I mean, do they have those requests to support them in what they are doing so well on Twitter, also on other platforms like LinkedIn or Instagram or the others? And how do you go about that?
Well, the way we went about it is simply allowing them to share their tweets on other platforms. So on Instagram, we built a thing that creates an image with your tweet inside of it that you could post to Instagram automatically. Yeah. On LinkedIn, you could post either the tweet or write a longer version of it, or actually use AI to expand your short tweet into a longer form LinkedIn post or Facebook post. The idea was pretty simple. You already have a bunch of content on Twitter. We're just going to make it easier for you to post on other platforms and build an audience on those other platforms.
Yeah. Do you see people being successful with that? Or does each platform require its own magic?
I don't think there's any magic. I think there's only consistency matters. That's what I saw personally. So the social media game is just about consistency. So first, finding your own voice, you know, and being able to produce your content, to write your tweets, to create your videos, whatever, and then being consistent in posting them, and eventually it picks up, you know. Eventually you're going to find people who like what you say and how you say it and your personality, etc. Because you take any field in the world, there are like millions or thousands of people speaking about this field, you know. Yeah. But each one has their own audience because they have their own personality, their own voice, their own way of explaining things, etc. So people are on social media, they need to find their voice. And then being consistent, that's where tools like Hyperion, I'm not trying to plug Hyperion, but that's where it's good, because you can schedule all your content and have it go there, and you don't have to worry, I forgot to post my tweets today. It's already the afternoon and I haven't posted anything, and I missed like the morning times, you know? So there is no magic, really. It's just consistency. People always try to find these hacks and secrets and cheat codes and all that stuff. I think it's just noise.
Yeah,
I think it's just noise. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, because what works for one person has to do with the context that person is in, the audience that they have built, and what works for them doesn't work for a lot of other people. That's the way
it
is.
What was your question? Because I think I went into a rabbit hole here. I spoke for too long. What was the initial question?
No, that was about the the focus. The focus question is a very important one. And focus can also mean, okay, people ask us to do things or to help them with LinkedIn and with Instagram and so on, but we stay focused on Twitter. They can also turn it around and say, hey, building the business only on Twitter, it can also be a danger to the company. So we are strategically putting our eggs in two boxes.
Yeah, well, one very simple thing that people don't often realize is that whatever time you spend on something, you don't spend on something else. So whatever time you're going to try to build something crazy for our platform, it's the time you're not spending improving the, for example, for us, it will be maybe, I don't know, focusing on Instagram, which is very different than Twitter, which we already do. So that's the time we're going to spend on Instagram, not spend on Twitter that we can improve, you know? So it's opportunity cost, really.
Let me make a small interruption here. Sava just made an excellent remark that sets his approach apart from founder ego. He admitted that his best ideas usually flop, and his users' requests always work. This brutal honesty about founder delusion is what keeps Hype Fury focused on actual problems instead of imaginary ones. And this is what remarkable SaaS companies do. They acknowledge they cannot please everyone. Then, they master the art of curiosity. And lastly, they focus on the essence. Do you want to master these traits as well? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. It is, exactly. So how do you go about that? How do you make those fundamental decisions at the end? Because you decided at the end to say, hey, I'm going to support my customers on those platforms.
I mean, for us, personally, for Hype Fury, we can support them. You know, we can allow you, like I said, generate your nice Instagram image, allow you to post it. Yeah. But that's going to be about it, you know.
So it's on the side, but the core focus remains on staying the go-to platform for Twitter.
Exactly. But it's going to change, by the way. It's going to change now. We already support a bunch of platforms, but only for Twitter users. So you need to be a Twitter user to use our platform. But then we're going to expand a little bit, try to get various customers from various platforms, get the people who use only Instagram and maybe they want to use Twitter too, get the people who want to use LinkedIn and they want to use Instagram to allow them to create multiple versions of each piece of content and post them on the platforms. But yeah, initially we're staying focused because when you start, you have so much on your plate. You know, you don't even have the time to be picky about things and sit down and think, oh, what am I going to work on this? You don't have that luxury. You don't have that time, you know? Mm-hmm. You have new ideas, future ideas coming in all the time. You're working on the stuff you're working on. You're late on some stuff you're working on. And then it's like, you know, it's a constant cycle until you reach a point where you're like, you know, I'm happy with what I have. There isn't much innovation I can do in this area. You know, we've already got a bunch of nice working features that people use. Yeah. Then I'm going to look into other platforms. Then I'm going to look into other things.
Okay. Are you following the same approach then, that you try to understand what are underserved areas on LinkedIn, for example, or underserved areas on Instagram, like you started with when you started Hype?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's this new platform we're building. Once we start sharing it with users, we're going to follow exactly the same strategy. So I'm probably going to create like a Telegram group with a bunch of core users for LinkedIn. and speak to them there and get their ideas and build something very specific to them for LinkedIn, and another one for Instagram, another one for that, etc. And it's a strategy that works, you know.
Yeah.
And me personally, I don't know LinkedIn that much, you know. I don't post on LinkedIn. I don't have a business on LinkedIn. So how can I decide which feature makes sense? I don't. They do, because they have their business on LinkedIn and they sell things on LinkedIn. So it is only natural. It makes sense that I go speak to them and get free, you know, free strategy for them, you know, free product management, really. Product, you know, free product owners. Your users are the product owners. You don't go, you don't need to go look for crazy ideas or things. You just need to speak to your users and they give you the tea.
Agree. Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it, but you are right. I mean, you spoke already twice now about the power of community. What do you believe is the power of community to hype future that others don't see? Because I mean, I don't see a lot of companies like leveraging community.
I can see why, because at some point you grow and you can't speak to everyone, you know, and you can't chat with everyone, have demos with everyone, and implement specific features from everyone. So I can understand how that happens. And it's true for us too, you know. I don't speak to our users on a daily basis about things. But it's good to always have that in mind, to keep that in mind, that in the end, it's the people who pay you who know what you need to do. They know better than you, you know. And so many times, and it happened to me personally, I think it happens a lot of times, you think of an idea and you're like, wow, that's, you know, that's the best thing I ever thought about. I'm going to build it. It looks so cool. You know, it looks so cool in your brain and on paper. And then you do it and it's a flop. So that's why you always need to talk to people, you know?
Yeah, and particularly people outside of the company. But I mean, you're absolutely right. I recently had someone on my podcast that had already started two companies, or three companies, I think. Oh, this is the third. He's now in his third. So the two companies before, he also realized that in the beginning, he was obsessed with customers. He could talk to them. But as the company started growing, the more distant this whole thing became. And not only with him, but everybody in the company, to the point that nobody talked to the customer anymore. And I've seen it happening as well. And that's a big risk. So community can be one aspect of it, but at the end you have to implement it in, across sales, across marketing, across product, across customer success. Everybody has their view on the community.
One easy thing anyone can do, I guess it wouldn't work for like bigger companies, it's just Telegram group, really. Mm-hmm. Just Telegram group with a few core people, you know, for example, your earliest users, the people who've been here with you for so long, and you have that group there. Sometimes they have an issue, they post on the group straight away. You ping support, you ping a developer, you fix the issue very quick for them, and then it strains that link. And then if they have an idea, they come up with it right away. So, you know, that's very basic, but it's a basic way to keep in touch with your community, you know, because you can talk to anyone, to everyone all the time. But if you have all of them there, sometimes you get an idea and like, hey guys, what do you think about this? Would you use it?
Yeah. The power is in the simplicity. You know, if it's complicated, you have to go to a particular portal and whatever. No, Telegram is just an app. Everybody is there.
Or WhatsApp, really. Like, whatever works.
Exactly.
There are no rules. You can do whatever you want. Whatever works for everyone. Well, whatever works for your users, especially.
Yeah, that's extremely important. Now, talking about this freedom thing, Bootstrap starts with, of course, okay, I'm building something and we earn more than we spend. So over the last 6-7 years, what have you found out as the biggest lever for increasing the profitability of the company, so that you gain more than you spend at the end?
Increase the price.
Yeah, no, good point.
It's one of the best ways, really, you know.
So how are you going about it?
I think we've done it twice in those 5 years.
I mean, let's ask another question then. Do you think you've done it enough?
Yeah, it depends on the market, really. On our market, you know, you have a price that you can't exceed. You know, if you can't sell like a basic Twitter scheduler, even Twitter other platform scheduler for, I don't know, $50. You can sell a premium version for $50, which we do. You know, you can even sell one for $100, $200. But you can say, hey, this is a tool that can allow you to post on Twitter and it's $50. That doesn't work. Yep. So there is a threshold that you can't exceed because other people, other companies do it for less. Yeah, so exactly. I think when I started, it was $12. And then at some point we bumped it to 20 and then 30. So, and 30 is, you know, I think the maximum you could really do, you know, otherwise it doesn't make sense, you know.
It's all about at the end. It goes back to your core group. You know, the people that where this is their, yeah, their lifeline, and they get so much value from it that even if it would be 100, it would be still peanuts. I mean, I'm a big fan of, for example, Superhuman, the email tool. From the beginning, I've paid 30, and I've been happy since. For an email tool, you know, but they deliver, and that's what it's all about. I mean, give it to someone else and they say 30 for or email. I'm just using out of the box this. So it's all about perspective.
I pay for it too, which is crazy.
Well, we say it's crazy, but still we do it and we get a lot of value from it. And they live up to their promise. I mean, I'm super fast with these things these days. So yeah, it's for some it will work and for others it will not work. And that's also what I mean with pricing. A lot of times what I see is that your pricing goes down because you're optimizing for the lowest denominator, the people that are not going to be a fan of your product anyway.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah. But what I noticed is that if you increase the price, you need to have a good reason. You can't tell your users, hey, I'm increasing the prices because I just want to. No, you can say, hey, in the last 2 years or in last year, we added this feature and this feature and this feature, they provide value. So we have a good reason to ask you for $10 more.
Completely agree. But what you can also do is like grandfather your existing users and keep experimenting, like what is the best threshold for new?
Sure, you could do that. But a lot of times your most loyal users would happily pay more.
Exactly.
Unless maybe double the prices or triple them, but...
Exactly.
As long as it stays reasonable, they're more than happy to pay.
And that's why I'm asking the question. A lot of companies underestimate the leverage you get from that. And there is absolutely stretch as long as your focus is the right one. For so often, the people that love the product most, they say it's so cheap for what they get from it. And that's where you leave money on the table. I mean, and the other thing is also sometimes... I spoke to the CEO of a company called, I think it's called Dream Influence from Denmark on this podcast. He came in as the CEO. The company was in trouble. They had a very high churn rate. I think it was well above 20%. And when he came in, he didn't start looking for, okay, why is he 20% leaving? He's looking for, okay, why is the 80% staying? And what are they doing different? And what he figured out is that the people that stayed, they were committed to stay long enough to get value from the product, whereby the people that wanted to have the hacks, they were finished after 3 days and unsubscribed. So what he did is like the minimum contract is 6 months, and he solved the problem immediately. And then they started raising prices, and he did it, I think, 6 times in 1 year, up to the point where he agreed with his CTO, that was previously the CEO, that when like more than 30% of our new customers start complaining about the new price, likely we have reached the point then. And I think they've sixfolded the price, which is crazy.
Wow. Yeah, it's crazy. And 6 months contract is crazy too. What kind of product is it? B2B?
Yeah, B2B influencer platform.
Okay. Okay.
Anyway, looking at the time, let me see. Yeah, I mean, 2019, starting the company, 2025 right now, how has your definition of success changed over that time? Are you looking at it differently?
Mm. Yeah, success. First thing would be being platform independent, you know, because that's a big issue in our business. Being dependent on one single platform, not good.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons we're expanding. You know, if we offer five different or six different platforms, what happened with Twitter with us could happen again, and it wouldn't matter. Because what happened with Twitter is that after the purchase by Elon Musk, they started charging us $500,000 a year, which is crazy because we're you know, we're still small bootstrapped startup, and well, we couldn't say no, you know. So if it comes to that with another platform, if tomorrow Facebook decides to charge us crazy amounts, we can just say, hey, no thanks, goodbye.
True. So that's also part of the freedom part, you know, keeping
exactly,
the company.
Yeah,
free.
I was about to say that. Yeah, it's exactly part of being free and doing what you want and not having a boss, you know, because at the end, if you're platform dependent, you're having a boss that tells you how you need to do things. Maybe they can even tell you that you are too cheap and need to increase the prices, get into financial details with you, etc. So yeah, freedom is bootstrapped.
Yeah, it's a perfect word.
Platform dependent, having your customers, lifestyle impact, you know, being free and however you manage time. Having multiple platforms obviously goes into the business side of freedom. Working for a good exit for sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of success, actually. Your question was about success. So yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Preparing for an exit. Maybe not, you know, maybe with this new platform, there's going to be new opportunities, bigger cash flow, hopefully. We're planning for that. So maybe you wouldn't even want to sell. Because we've had that mindset in the beginning, you know, like, there's no reason to sell. You know, the business is growing month to month. It's all good. Why would we sell it, you know?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it's more about the journey then, you know, then it's fun and you wake up every morning with energy to do, yeah, that extra mile again. And that's also what it takes to kind of build remarkable software companies. And then the exit will just be bigger at the end if you decide to, but it's in your hands. Last question then, from your experience as an entrepreneur, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with peers that aspire similar success?
Do easy, speak to your customers, you know, get to know them, create a community. It could be 5 people, 10 people. They are your product owners. So speak to them. They're going to tell you what to do. If you're unsure, they're going to tell you what to do. It's free consulting for you. You know, it's a win situation for you.
True.
The don't, I don't know about the don't. There are too many don'ts, you know. First thing that comes into my mind is don't spread, you know, stay focused on one thing. It's really that, you know, always keep in mind the opportunity cost. You know, if I go chase this shiny, sexy thing, what am I leaving behind? What am I taking my attention from?
Yeah,
you know,
true.
And in that time, you're going to chase the new shiny thing. There are so many things that you could have done with your core business, your core thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well said. Where can people go to find out more about Hype Fury or to say hi to you?
Yeah, hypefury.com. That's it. Or Hype Fury on Twitter, on X. Now it's called X. So Hype Fury on X.
Yeah,
and keep follow us on X. And we're going to have a new version of Hype Fury released soon with support for a lot of platforms. And you can create your content, use AI to create other versions of it for different platforms and have all that stuff posted automatically and growing your audience on social media.
Okay. Well said. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your, the lessons that you shared, the story behind Hype Fury. I'll keep following you for the next 5 years.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
Pleasure. And this wraps up my conversation with Sami Dindan, CEO of Hype Fury. If you got value from this episode, please share it with other SaaS founders who need to hear this as well. And if you got 10 seconds,
A quick rating or review on Apple Podcasts will help more people to find these conversations. Thank you for listening to the Remarkable SaaS podcast. If you want more insights like this, subscribe to my daily email, Espresso with Torm. It's a 2-minute shot of clarity for SaaS founders who want to create pull, not push. You can sign up, along with getting my book, at valueinspiration.com. See you in the next episode.